Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to episode 269. Today you'll hear the success story of a woman named Joanna. She is a 34-year-old teacher who enjoys baking, reading, and listening to podcasts. Joanna and her husband waited a year after getting married before they started trying to conceive. A year later, when they still weren't successful, she consulted her OBGYN. She was referred to a reproductive endocrinologist. All of their initial testing came back normal, except for elevated thyroid levels. After unsuccessful timed intercourse and IUI cycles, they moved on to IVF. Their first fresh transfer ended in a missed miscarriage. Their second retrieval resulted in two normal embryos. Prior to transferring, they did an ERA, which showed she was receptive, but the FET still failed. At a low point in their journey, they consulted with me about the next steps. I recommended they switch to a specific clinic and doctor. They did two retrievals, which resulted in seven normal embryos. Their first FET ended in a blighted ovum. Let's listen to how Joanna did one more transfer and is now in her second trimester. Hi, Joanna. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. How are you? I'm so happy to be here and finally be on. I feel like I've been trying to, I wanted to fill out the paperwork for a while and finally I did. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really good to talk to you again. I know about you, and we'll get to that a little bit later, but why don't you introduce yourself to the audience? How old are you? What do you do for a living? And what do you do for fun?
So I am 34. I'm a teacher. I guess what I do for a living as a teacher, I teach middle school, eighth grade social studies. And in terms of fun, I guess I love to bake. I'm a big avid baker and reader. And pre-COVID, I was a really big traveler. My husband and I love to take a lot of trips and do things like that. Other than that, trying to stay active and kind of find some new hobbies during COVID, I guess.
Think about life before infertility. Back then, how would you describe yourself as a person?
So before infertility, I would say I possibly would describe myself as almost naive to certainly infertility or kind of the struggles and things that happened with it. I also think I was the type of person that I thought if I, you know, I had always worked really hard for things and I was able to kind of achieve them. So I always had the impression that, you know, you put your mind to it, you do something and it can come to you. You know, it might not come easily, but it can certainly. And I think when I encountered infertility, it was something that kind of rocked my world and rocked my experiences and the things that I've had. And I realized, yes, I can work hard at it, but sometimes things are out of my control, which was certainly a learning experience for me.
Tell me about the first time you met your husband.
So my husband and I met online, and we actually, when he messaged me, he was 24 and I was 27. And I was really hesitant to respond to him because of his age. I felt like it was a little bit too young for me. So I didn't respond for a few days. And then for some reason, I kind of kept going back to his picture and his message. And I did. And we corresponded for a while before we actually met. And it was the night before Thanksgiving, about 7 years ago at this point. And we met for a drink and just hit it off. I think right away, it was somebody that I felt a really natural connection with. And then from thereafter, we were together. We went on a following date that weekend and just saw each other. We were somewhat long distance, I would say. And his job at the time made it so that we could really only see each other on the weekends, which worked out. But we just were together after that.
Today, how would you describe you and your husband as a couple?
I guess I would say we're opposites. I guess I do believe in opposites attracting. He is very fun-loving, very impulsive. He kind of is always goofy and pretty jolly. And I would say I am certainly more serious. I'm not so impulsive. I really have to think everything out. So I think we are a nice complement to each other. When I was thinking about writing our kind of vows for our wedding, I always think about kind of my life before Jeff. And sometimes it's like a funny analogy I use, but when I started meeting, when I met him, he would cook a lot and he always liked to make me salads. And he would always put like a lot of fun things on the salad that I had never done. I would just have had dressing and like maybe some croutons, and he always put like all these things. So I always think that he kind of adds that component of kind of fun and like variety to my life, and kind of helps me be a little bit not high strung or high stressed as I am.
I am definitely the not fun person in our relationship as well. I try. I mean, I have fun, you know, myself, but apparently I am not very fun to others. I'm kind of bland. So there's that.
That's how I feel.
I think that's why you and I get along so well. It's just, you know, hey, someone has to be the more fun one, right? And it just does. You and I, we just don't fall into that category. Yeah. It's totally okay. So was there a specific moment in your life when you first knew you wanted to be a mom?
I'm not sure if there was a specific moment. I think it was always part of my plan for my life. I think going back to kind of how I'm pretty serious and think everything out, I kind of had a very specific plan for how I wanted my life to go. And I know that that included, I have two sisters and we played a lot with, you know, played with our babies when we were younger, which was always a fun time. And I just kind of said that would be the natural progression of my life. And I think I couldn't imagine my life without kids is really kind of the moment, I guess. There was never a moment I didn't think I wanted to have kids.
How did longing to be a mom impact other decisions in your life?
In terms of my career, so like I mentioned, I am a middle school teacher. I always wanted to be a teacher. I actually have read Curly Hair. And when I was younger, I used to love the story of the magic school bus. So I always felt like I was Miss Frizzle. And I think that as much as it kind of fit into the life that I think that I wanted in terms of teaching with the hours and having the summers off. So I knew that it would work well having children and kind of make it be a little bit easier, depending on certainly before I was married, what I wasn't sure what my partner was going to do. And I think that now looking back on it, I'm happy that I did that because I think it's afforded me some opportunities. And then hopefully when I have kids to be a little bit more flexible. In terms of how buying a house, so my husband and I actually just recently bought our second house together. And when we were even buying our first house, we were really looking in areas that had good school districts. So that really was kind of determining where our location and kind of search was for a house. We wanted a house in a location that we could afford, but then also have a good school district so that if we had kids when we had kids, they would be able to go.
Let's dive into the journey to build your family. Take us through your whole infertility timeline, step by step.
Okay. So I feel like it's pretty long. I remember when I wrote it out for the interview questionnaire, I was almost shocked about it, but I was able to remember it very easily. So my husband and I were married in July of 2016, and I knew that I wanted to wait a little bit to start trying to have a baby. So we waited about a year. And the spring of spring of 2017, I had an IUD and I actually had it removed. I kind of said, all right, we're going to start actively. And so that kind of spring and summer, we were actively trying. I eventually started to buy ovulation test strips and kind of get a little bit more serious about it, started tracking my cycles. We ended up doing a really big construction project in our house kind of the fall of 2017. So I knew we were going to try, but kind of throughout the fall and into the winter when we were not having success, I started to get a little anxious about it. So I figured that I said, let's kind of put it on the back burner. So we were trying, but not actively. I kind of abandoned the ovulation test strips because it just induced so much anxiety for me. I had even tried to temp my body temperature and it was just a little bit too much for me. So through that winter, I would say we were trying, but not really, not actively. So I kind of put having a baby, you know, in the back of my mind. I knew that I wanted it, but we were kind of undertaking this. We were putting a brand new kitchen in and redoing the first floor of our house. So I said, maybe it's better if we wait a little bit. Eventually finished the construction project. And the summer of 2018, I actively started to try again. And so I was really using the ovulation test strips, and I kind of kept getting positives every month, but to no avail, and was not getting any positive pregnancy tests. So in the fall of 2018, I had my annual with my OB. So I thought it would be a really good time to talk to him about kind of, we'd been trying for about a year at that point. My periods were also becoming really worse almost. I've kind of had a history of cramps and kind of really painful periods. And in the fall, kind of September, October of 2018, it became much worse. I was really getting up in the middle of the night with these really terrible cramps. So I figured I would kind of mention it to him. He was not, I guess, my OB, his personality is a little bit nonchalant. I really liked him. He had a very good bedside manner, but he was a little bit like, well, just keep trying. I think you'll be fine. Come back to me. So I believe that was in like September of 2018. And I said, okay, you know, he knows what he's talking about. So I had been communicating with my sister a little bit about it because she had also experienced infertility. And she kind of said, well, maybe wait a little bit, but go back and push for a referral to an RE. So at the end of October 2018, kind of beginning of November 2018, I made a follow-up with my OB and explained, you know, I think something's going on and I really would like to get to the bottom of it. He did some initial blood testing, my OB, that just kind of showed that I believe my progesterone was low. So he got on board with agreeing to refer me to an RE. So I came home with the referrals and actually called my sister, who helped me. And she showed me some of the websites online that were able to Fertility IQ and things like that to be able to look at the referrals. We selected a clinic that is a really big university kind of hospital near my house in New York. And they luckily had a satellite office that was not far from my home. So we were able to get in, I believe, middle of November of 2018. And we went in for our initial testing, kind of had an HSG, we had an MRI. My family has a history of multiple kidney organs. So the RE explained to me that sometimes that can be like an anatomical issue when your kidney and your kind of reproductive system, they develop together, was something that he explained to me. So I thought that was interesting. So that was part of why we did the MRI. We also had a blood panel, and the only thing that really came back was that I had a high TSH and kind of a low, on the lower side, AMH for my age. We could not get back in to kind of do our follow-up with our RE until December of 2018, and he wanted to jump right into kind of IUI and said that would be great because of my husband's sperm parameters were pretty good. So he said, I think that might be the best place to start. I was a little bit hesitant initially, just because I think I had to wrap my brain around the fact that we needed infertility treatment. So I waited and I said, let me try the TSH, my thyroid medicine, to see if I can get my TSH down and kind of see if that helps. So I started the medicine in December, and then January, we returned to the clinic and we decided to do a cycle of timed intercourse. And that was with Clomid. I really disliked Clomid. It was terrible. I had such a terrible, awful reaction to it hormonally. And just, I felt terrible. It also really thinned my lining. So that month, the timed intercourse was unsuccessful. The next month, we jumped into an IUI cycle. And I was hesitant to go ahead with Clomid, but my doctor at the time said, well, you responded. You had, I think, like three follicles. So it worked well, despite the fact that your lining was thin. And looking back, I think I wish I had pushed for something different, but we went ahead with the IUI and it was unsuccessful. I would always get my period before I would have to go in for a beta. And I didn't have any progesterone support kind of after the IUI. We again decided, we said, okay, we'll try another IUI. But my doctor was willing to change the meds, and we decided to do a cycle with letrozole. And similarly, in March 2019, I responded well to the medicine. I did not have as many side effects with letrozole. I also, my lining kind of was not thin, so I was pretty hopeful in that cycle just because I think I felt better on those meds as well. And I think, again, I had about three follicles, so we were hoping it would be successful. Unfortunately, it wasn't. And I think at this point I was feeling a little bit desperate. So we jumped right into IVF. We had to take an IVF class with my clinic, and we rushed to do that at the end of March. And it was kind of a crazy time. It was my husband's 30th birthday. We were at a surprise party, my sister-in-law's bachelorette party. It was just a lot going on. So in hindsight, I wish maybe I had waited a month, but we jumped right into IVF in April 2019, and it was our first cycle. So according to my kind of hormone panel and levels, my doctor was very optimistic. He said, I think you will only need one IVF cycle to have the children you want, which I was really happy to hear. But I did not respond in the way that he thought I was going to. So it was, we used Gonalef, low dose. I believe I was only on like 150, 200, Menopur. And then we did, I think I stimmed for about 10 or 11 days. And we used a dual trigger, so HCG and Lupron. And we retrieved, I believe it was 9 or 10 eggs, but we had an incredibly low fertilization rate. And for some reason, we had chosen to do ICSI. I'm not sure why. And in retrospect, I'm happy we did, because I don't know if any of our eggs would have fertilized. So I think 3 ended up fertilizing, 7 were mature, but only 3 fertilized. And we ended up doing a day 5 fresh transfer. We had 2 blasts make it, which I was disappointed with, but I now, having gone through this, I know that that can be a pretty good outcome. So we transferred 1 embryo at the end of April, and I ended up getting a positive pregnancy test, which was really unexpected for me. We ended up, unfortunately, so kind of continued to go back to our RE and kind of do our early monitoring for the pregnancy. And it ended up in a miscarriage in May 2019. We had a DNC on the advice of my doctor, because he said, let's test the products of conception to see if it was, if it's a something chromosomal abnormality, which the testing revealed after the DNC. I would say that was a pretty low point in my journey, but I think I was still hopeful, because I said, okay, I got pregnant in that first round. So something worked. We just have to find the right embryo at this point. So May and June of 2019 were just kind of spent recovering. It took me a while to get my cycle back and for my HCG level to drop. But in the interim, we kind of set up a plan for what was to come next. We consulted with our RE again, and he felt that we should have some additional blood testing done, the karyotype blood testing, which for both my husband and I came back normal. I also was interested in having a second opinion with a doctor that my sister used. So my sister at this time was living in the Midwest, and she had found success with a doctor similar to us, had been at a clinic and had changed. So I said, you know what, she had a lot of great success. Her and I, our diagnosis are not the same, but I do think I'd like to hear what he has to say. So I was able to set up a consult with this doctor. So we did that in early July. And this doctor recommended higher dose of meds for the next cycle. He also said adding in letrozole could potentially help in terms of kind of egg quality. He also recommended some supplements. So he said try to add ubiquinol or CoQ10, and kind of recommended some additional testing for my husband, kind of do the DNA fragmentation test, also have him start CoQ10. So I brought these kind of notes from this other doctor to my RE, and he was really amenable to trying some of these things. So he wasn't necessarily so on board with higher doses of meds, but he was willing to add in the letrozole, which I felt was kind of a win. And he also said, you know, there's no harm in taking the CoQ10. So we started that, Beth and I. So we plan to do another retrieval that August. In the interim, I had an HSG and everything was clear. For IVF cycle 2, we also, I forgot to mention, decided to do estrogen priming. So my RE at the time was a little bit miffed by kind of the results that I had from the first cycle, just because of kind of what my hormone levels were. He said, I thought we would have a much better response. So he said, let's try priming, which we did, just estrogen priming I think it was about a week before, or I don't remember exactly, but this was July 2018 into August 2019. And we started IVF cycle two, where when I got my period, I didn't start stimming right away. I actually took letrozole for 3 days, and then I added in the Gonalef and the Menopur, again with the dual trigger. This cycle, we almost canceled because when I went in for kind of my mid-cycle monitoring, I only had like 4 or 5 follicles. So I'm not sure if that was maybe in response to the estrogen priming and kind of maybe being suppressed. So we decided to go forward with it, despite kind of my reservations, and part of it had to do with our insurance coverage. We only had a certain number of cycles covered, but we did go forward with it, and we ended up retrieving 10 eggs. So more than we thought, but same thing. We had a little bit of better fertilization rate, and we were able to make a few more blasts. So on day 5, we had 4 blasts. And with this particular cycle, we opted to do PGT. So we ended up thawing the embryo from our April cycle and sending it for PGT. When we got those results, it took a while, but in September of 2019, we found out that we had 2 PGT normal embryos and 1 low-level mosaic, which actually the low-level mosaic was from my first cycle. So it's interesting to really kind of say we didn't get any normal embryos from the first cycle. So we felt pretty confident, but were a little bit nervous because we had so few embryos. But we did want to give it an opportunity to transfer a normal embryo. So I went back and forth. When I had consulted with the other doctor over the summer, he had recommended that if we got to the transfer stage, to do an ERA, which my clinic was not, they didn't do, but I was able to push my doctor and said, I really want to do this. So October of 2019, we prepped for an ERA and did it, and it came back as receptive. From there, we kind of rolled right into an FET, and that was in November of 2019, which actually was unsuccessful, which was a really hard point, I would say, in our journey, because we felt like we had done so much to kind of ensure that this would work, and it didn't. My doctor didn't have a ton of insight into possibly why. He had mentioned there had always been talk that I had endo or endometriosis just because of my painful periods, kind of really a lot of leg pain and just kind of some things that have been throughout my reproductive history. His recommendation was to do a laparoscopy, which I felt like might be the next step, but I was a little bit uncertain just from some of the listening that I've done to the podcast, that it's really important that you have a specialist do it. So he wanted to do it. And I said, okay, we need to kind of regroup at this point. So my husband and I kind of took off December, I would say, and just recentered and kind of said, what do we want to do? Do we want to continue with this clinic in terms of him doing the laparoscopy? Do we want to seek out a specialist? And that was when my sister recommended that I consult with Heather, which I'm so happy that I did. So almost a little bit over a year ago, the early January of 2020, I made an appointment and I did a deep dive with Heather, and she provided a lot of insight into kind of some things that might be going on, and then referred us to an endo specialist as well as a few new clinics in our area. I left the appointment with Heather kind of feeling really hopeful, because I think the last few months I had felt like I didn't know what our next steps were. I knew I wanted to change something up, and I felt like now we had a direction. So in February or early February or end of January 2020, I actually had an appointment with an endo specialist in New York City. And he said, from looking and I got my history doing an exam, he said, I definitely would recommend a laparoscopy. And we were on board to do that, to kind of find out about my possible endo and really confirm it with the lap. We also had an appointment with our new clinic. So they were about a week apart, those appointments. In February 2020, we went to our new clinic, which is somewhat in the area. We had to drive a little bit, but it was totally worth it. And our consult, I was anxious because I worried that we would have to redo all of the testing, But fortunately, the new clinic took some of our testing from our old clinic and kind of had us update some blood work, including an MTFHR blood test, which we had never had done. And the doctor also recommended that my husband and I go on a ton of supplements, as well as me following a gluten and dairy-free diet. So our initial consult with the new clinic was really hopeful. And the doctor, I felt, was really straightforward, said, I think it's going to be a challenge, but I do believe that we will get you to where you want to be, Joanna, which was nice to hear, because he didn't sugarcoat it, but he was very direct. And I said, this is what I think what the plan should be. And then I also felt the fact that they were giving us supplements and kind of this diet piece to gave me some control over the process, which I think, like I kind of mentioned, is hard to lose that control. So I said, okay, this is something that I actively can do to potentially help my outcome. So we spoke with him also about doing the laparoscopy, and he kind of said, I think he wasn't, I guess he's one of the REs. I know there's kind of two different that believe you should have it, and then others that don't. He kind of said, I think we should wait. I'm not saying don't, and you certainly can if you want, but my opinion is to let's try a cycle. Let's see what happens. We do things very differently here. So my husband and I were feeling better. We had a plan. We left that day. We were starting CoQ10. We were starting kind of NAC, DHEA, vitamin D. So a lot of things that we had never done before. We also, the blood testing from that day also revealed that my husband and I both have the MTFHR mutation. So we both started to take Methylguard. So this was in February of 2020, and we were waiting to get approval from insurance to start our next IVF cycle. So that was actually in March of 2020, which is when we began IVF number 3. And I was super worried about the cycle being canceled because it was right at the kind of height of COVID, or when everything started to shut down. So we were monitoring with our clinic a lot, and they did stay open throughout all of COVID, which I feel very fortunate about. Since I am a teacher, I was working from home, so it made it a little bit easier for me to get to the clinic for monitoring in kind of March of 2020, because I didn't have to commute to work every day. So I could drive the hour and a half and see my new doctor, which was a blessing in disguise. So March of 2020, we started a luteal phase start for my IVF cycle. So I ended up with a decent amount. So we ended up retrieving 10 eggs, so similar to my other cycles, but 9 were mature. So a lot more were mature than my previous cycles. And from that, we actually ended up with 2 normal embryos, which I was a little bit disappointed with, because I felt like, okay, we had done so much differently. I was hoping for something different, but I definitely felt fortunate to have this. And we found out the sex of the embryos, and I said, okay, I feel good about this. But we did pursue a duo stim. So about a week after I had my retrieval, we started another stim cycle. So I never got a period. I right in between. So in April of 2020, I started meds again, and it was actually the same meds as March. So the high dose Gonal-F, low dose HCG with the same trigger. And we ended up retrieving the same amount. So kind of, I'm always consistent throughout cycles. It was 10 eggs. We ended up with 5 normal embryos from that cycle. So that was certainly our most successful cycle. I can't say whether it was the supplements had a longer time to kind of take effect, or it was the diet. I had been on the gluten and dairy-free diet for longer, but we were thrilled with those results and really ready to move into a transfer. So in May of 2020, we had seen a polyp, or my doctor had seen a polyp during my retrieval cycle. So he recommended doing a saline sonogram so that we could possibly see if it's still there and if it needed to be removed. So May of 2020, we went back in for the saline sonogram and the polyp had resolved. My doctor mentioned that it probably had to do with the fact that I was just on such a high dose of meds that kind of maybe made the polyp react. So we were pretty excited that that had resolved, because then we could jump into a transfer and we didn't have to wait for hospital centers to start doing elective surgeries. Because at this point, or last May, COVID, obviously, things were still pretty much shut down. And in my area, they weren't doing elective surgeries. So I would have had to wait to get the polyp removed. In June of 2020, we did our second FBT at our new clinic. And their transfer protocol was fairly different from my previous cycle. So I had done estrogen patches and obviously progesterone oil in my previous cycle. But with this, we did oral estrus as well as progesterone oil. But then I also did Metrogel the night before the transfer. And then about an hour before the transfer, a progesterone suppository. So we went into that transfer feeling pretty hopeful. It was sad my husband couldn't be there at our previous clinic. My husband was never allowed to come even pre-COVID. It was in a hospital, but at this clinic, they usually allow partners. So he sat in the parking lot, which I'm sure many people can relate to. He watched them do the transfer and we felt hopeful and went in and had a positive beta. And this was towards the end of June and our numbers were really going up in a way that made us feel positive. Early July, we went, or I guess it was even the end, I don't remember the exact timing, but we went in to confirm that it was an intrauterine pregnancy, which it was. And then the following week, we were hoping to see kind of, I believe it was a yolk sac. When we went in, there was nothing. So there was maybe a hint of a yolk sac. And I remember being pretty shattered. And my husband was down in the parking lot and he kept trying to be hopeful because the doctor, it was not my doctor that I saw. I was actually at a satellite office of my clinic that's a little bit closer to my house. And she didn't have the best bedside manner and just said, well, it should be here by now, but like it might not be, you know, we'll come back in 4 days. So my nurse followed up with me and I haven't mentioned her before, but my nurse was unbelievable. She really was great. And she kind of talked me through it and said, like, this does happen, Joanna. And really, when you go back, it could be a viable pregnancy. Let's wait and see. So I ended up going back about 3 or 4 days later. And I ended up seeing my nurse that morning, which was really nice. She was doing the temperature checking at the front of the building. And when I went in, they confirmed that it was a blighted ovum and it were an anembryonic pregnancy, which I think is the term that's being used now. So we were pretty crushed about that. My doctor called and we were able to speak to him and he kind of reassured me that this happens. It's definitely not, he said it's not common with PGT, but it can happen. But that he still felt hopeful and said, like, we just have to try again. We just have to get the right embryo. So July of 2020 or August, July and August, I pushed for a recurrent loss panel. I was just concerned. I wanted to make sure that we uncovered everything before we did another transfer. So we ended up doing a recurrent loss panel, a repeat saline sonogram, and everything on the recurrent loss panel came back normal. So we prepped for FET number 3, which ended up being in September of 2020. It was actually the first day of school, which lined up, which was kind of a crazy year anyway because of COVID, but I said, okay, this is it. So it might have been good timing because I didn't have as much time to really focus and kind of have so much anxiety about the transfer. So on September 2nd, we transferred our fourth embryo at this point, but third FET, and it was successful. So we had a positive beta, and I am currently 25 weeks with that pregnancy.
Hey, infertility warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. In addition to hosting this podcast, I'm an infertility coach who supports warriors just like you. Regular listeners know that I struggled during my journey to make good decisions and advocate for myself. As a result, it took 5 years, $75,000, 3 egg retrievals, 7 embryo transfers, 4 miscarriages, and 2 stillbirths before I finally had my daughter. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side, I help people like you navigate the complicated world of fertility treatments and other paths to parenthood. I help people like you make scientifically based, well-informed decisions about your next steps rather than relying on Dr. Google and Facebook groups. I help people like you prepare for appointments, identify opportunities to ask questions, and advocate for yourself. I help people like you become an active member of your fertility treatment team rather than blindly trusting the decisions that are made for you. I help people like you become a parent faster. I only have a couple of slots open and they generally fill up fast. So if this is the help you need, reach out today. Tell me your story and learn more about how I can support you during your infertility journey at beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. Yay, I am so excited for you. It's great to hear your whole story. After we had that one call, it's so awesome to hear what happened after that.
It is.
I want to take a few steps back. I'd like to hear more about your family history of infertility.
My family actually has not a long history of infertility, but I do have two maternal aunts that couldn't have children. And then there was really, I guess at the time when they were trying to have children, there wasn't certainly the technology that we have today, which I feel so fortunate for. So it was something that I always was aware of growing up. So I guess in the beginning when I said I was naive to infertility, I think I was just more naive to the process and kind of the lack of control. Because growing up, I knew that this was always a possibility. And it was certainly something that I feared and kind of thought potentially there might be something up. Because I've had a history of painful periods. I had ruptured ovarian cysts as a teenager. So my two maternal aunts couldn't have children, never really revealed a cause why. And then I have two sisters, and my middle sister had her own infertility struggles. So she had a completely different diagnosis. So my diagnosis ended up being, from my second clinic, diminished ovarian reserve with possible endometriosis. And she had a PCOS diagnosis and some other things, male factor going on. So it was interesting, I think, to have gone through this experience, having a family history. I think it's made me more compassionate to my family members, especially my aunts, and kind of understanding family dynamics. My mom is the one sister that of her three that has three children and had no problems. I have a similar situation in my family with three daughters, and my oldest sister had children, could blink and would get pregnant. I think it's an interesting like familial learning experience, especially because of our family history. And I think it's made me be a little bit more proactive or kind of thinking about with when I hopefully bring this baby into the world, kind of her fertility journey and kind of trying to key into that early if there are problems or if I suspect endometriosis or really communicating with her doctors and things like that.
Did any of your doctors say anything about the family history and how that might have impacted you?
So they did. So basically the first RE was really interested in it. And he kind of, there must be something going on. He said, I would love to know kind of more information about your aunts, which they're much older now. So they don't have as much. But with my sister, he did want to know exactly kind of what her diagnosis was and kind of what her protocols were. So that was why he was, I think, amenable to kind of me getting the second opinion with the doctor that my sister used, which was helpful. So even my new doctor kind of said, you know, it just happens. It's kind of a roll of the dice with families. But I think it's something my sister and I talk about a lot, and we would love to find out more about it and certainly see what's going on with our family, that this seems to be like in every generation, like at least two of us that have these issues.
While still trying to conceive on your own, what was the first sign you might want to consult a medical professional? And did your family history play into how soon you saw a doctor?
So it definitely did. My sister was kind of in the height of her infertility journey when I kind of started trying to conceive. So she had said to me, if you are trying to have a baby and you can't, and it's been 6 months, 8 months, you need to be proactive, Shauna. She said, you know, we really obviously, unfortunately, have this family history and like, we don't know what you have going on. So like, it's worth investigating. I think that was always in the back of my mind. And I unfortunately think I always kind of sensed that I might have fertility issues just because of my painful periods. And I went on birth control very young because I did have ovarian cysts that would burst and that were extremely painful. So that was always a fear of mine. And I think once we started to try to conceive and we weren't successful, it made me especially anxious, but really say, okay, I need to get on this. I wish I had gone even sooner, but I think the fact that we had so much going on in our life, I was able to kind of put it out of my brain. And that's kind of why in the fall of 2018, I really took control and said, I need to advocate and talk to my doctor. But I guess the biggest thing to me that signaled that we probably had an issue were my really painful periods. And the fact that I was getting these positive ovulation tests kind of month after month and nothing was happening. And I felt like we were trying all different types of things and nothing was successful. So that really was kind of saying, I think there's something up and need to investigate more.
And endo wasn't something that your first doctor even talked about, right?
Not at all. He kind of was like, no, I don't think it's a thing. We kind of just basically we treat everybody the same. Like the treatment for endo, according to him, was to get pregnant. But basically we would not change anything about what we're doing. So I guess that made me feel a little bit better, but I wish we had explored it further. I guess I didn't end up exploring it anyway with my second doctor either. And we've obviously since had a successful FET, but it's something that I, in hindsight, would love to. I was with my OB since I was almost 17 or 18. So it'd been a long time and I had been communicating with him about painful periods, about these terrible leg cramps, about the increased bowel movements I would have, and just these terrible kind of symptoms that were surrounding my period every month and even not around my period. And I wish he had taken it a little bit more seriously, or I had known a little bit more when I was younger to advocate for myself about it, to go and find out a little bit more and see if this endo is, you know, actually part of my diagnosis or if it's just suspected, and kind of get a confirmation on it.
Why did you decide to start with your OB rather than going straight to a fertility clinic?
I'm not sure. I think when I think about it, it was just kind of the logical step to me. I think it also helped because I did have a annual appointment around the time that I was kind of getting to the point where I said, I think we need help. I also thought I had to go to an OB to get a referral. But after realizing how easy it was for me to just call the clinics that he gave me the numbers to, it made me say, I guess I didn't really need a referral. So I would recommend potentially going right to an RE if you can. But I guess it was maybe a good first step. I don't really know now thinking back to it.
You sought a second opinion and brought the recommendations back to your first doctor. Why did you seek a second opinion after your first IVF cycle? And how did you choose the particular doctor to seek that second opinion with?
I think I was really disappointed by our first cycle. And I know sometimes, a lot of times in the infertility community, the first cycle is the test cycle. You don't really know how your body's going to respond. But the fact that we had such a low fertilization rate, I felt like something else was going on. And potentially it could be egg quality, or maybe there was some mention of my husband, we didn't really uncover this until our second clinic, but low morphology, or if there was more things that the first clinic was missing. They had a kind of a cookie cutter approach to the way that they did cycles. And I felt they're a huge hospital and I can't even imagine how many cycles a year, just knowing when I would go for monitoring in the morning, when I would have to go into New York City and there would be like almost 70 women in the waiting room, started to make me say, I would like a little bit more of a personalized approach. So since my sister had had success with her doctor and he had done something very different in her first clinic, I think was similar to the first clinic that I went to. It was, they put everybody kind of on the same dose of meds and the same thing, and it just kind of did the same thing over and over. I was hoping to get his insight about what he might do differently. I even considered like maybe abandoning my clinic and flying out to Chicago and going to this doctor. But we were able to actually do a Skype call, and I felt like he made some really good recommendations, especially the adding in the letrozole. And I think that might have contributed to us getting normal embryos or getting two normal embryos from that cycle, because in our previous cycle, we hadn't had any, but who knows? And I don't know if that was the sole factor, but I am glad that I did consult, because I think it pushed my first RE to make some changes. And I was happy that he was willing to make some changes. I wish he had been more on board with the higher doses of meds. The doctor that I got the second opinion from had to kind of do, I believe it was like a 300 or 400 gonalef and then double or like two vials of menopur. I don't remember what the amount is. And my current clinic at that time said, no, he said, that's too much meds. I don't want to do that. So they were a little bit more conservative. But it was interesting to just get that second opinion after our first cycle.
You talked about this a bit, but more specifically, how was your experience at your new clinic compared to the first clinic?
So our first clinic, I think we really just didn't know what it was going to be like. I had listened to the episode, I believe that was on the podcast. It's from a while ago, but it's like the first visit to your RE, things you should know, things you should ask for. And when we went, we were pretty happy. Like I mentioned, it was a satellite clinic, so it was much smaller. And it was really just my doctor and his staff that were there. We liked the doctor a lot. He did have a great bedside manner and he explained things really well, the first doctor. I did not love the rest of the clinic. I felt like I was like annoying the women that worked there, the nurses. Nobody was super friendly. The nurses that I had as like my IVF or my nurses that I could call with questions weren't so open. It was really hard to get a hold of them. I would call and it might take a day, 2 days to hear back from them about things. So my husband and I were a little bit turned off, but I think we liked the doctor so much and we just didn't know that the experience could be different. And it felt like at this clinic, even though the satellite office didn't have as many women as the New York City office, the way that they did monitoring was crazy. You would have to line up in the morning, basically outside the office. So I would have to get there super early. Monitoring didn't start till 7:30, which for me was really tough as a teacher. I didn't know what I didn't know. When I think about the second clinic, it was night and day. It's equally as large of a clinic. They're not associated with kind of a big hospital. So I guess it's more independent or more private, but it felt like a retreat. Like we went in on our first day and office staff was so friendly. They had us meet with a financial person. My first clinic didn't really have a financial person that I would speak to. I was more working with the hospital department, which was a nightmare to begin with. So the fact that I had a designated person that told me what my infertility benefits were and kind of what everything would cost me on that first consultation was amazing. And meeting with the doctor was also great. I felt like we met with him for probably almost an hour that first, maybe even longer that first day. And he really explained a lot of things, asked a lot of questions, and had a clear idea of kind of what he thought would be good for us. And I just felt like he wasn't giving me false hope, which I think my previous doctor had. And I felt better that, you know, he acknowledged that this could be challenging and that we might have a challenge, but that he believed that I could have a baby or as many kids as I wanted, or kind of how he said we can get you to have success, Joanna, which to me felt good. And then the fact that he also recommended the supplements and the diet, they also require or want you to see a nutritionist. So it was a more of a holistic approach. In addition, the nurse at my clinic that I was assigned to was unbelievable. She really would call me all the time. If I had any questions, I never felt silly asking her. And I felt that at my previous clinic, I felt like I was inconveniencing them. I was bothering them. Whereas it's this clinic, I felt like she was really there. She was advocating for me. And she was so kind and sympathetic. She had been through infertility herself. And after my kind of struggle, my blighted ovum, she kind of opened up and we talked a little bit. And I think it was just really helpful to just hear from somebody who obviously has a lot of knowledge in the fertility kind of side, medical side, but then in the personal side has also experienced it. So the new clinic was unbelievable. And I always say, I wish we had started there, but you know, we didn't know what we didn't know. And I always try whenever I talk to anybody, I've since referred to people and kind of try to say, or anybody that I know that's maybe considering infertility treatment, it doesn't have to be the way that I felt at my first clinic. You know, they're your doctors, you're hiring them, and you can look around, you can go to other places, which I'm not sure I thought kind of after our first visit at our first clinic.
How did you manage being a teacher and going through infertility treatments?
It was definitely difficult at my first clinic, especially because 7:30 monitoring hours would start. And my doctor was the only doctor at the clinic. So we would have to wait for him, and he was often late. And I worked about 30 minutes from where the clinic was. So I missed my first period a lot. Fortunately, I sometimes taught with somebody. I have a co-teacher in my first period, or the year that I started infertility treatments, I did. So he really shouldered a lot of the burden and was there with my students, but they would always be like, where are you? Why are you late? And that added stress to me, I would say. Once we transferred clinics, I was out of school or working remotely last spring when we were doing a lot of retrievals and monitoring. So that was helpful that I didn't have to report to school. And if school started a little bit later, I could log in from the computer. So really that was a blessing. But in terms of even taking days off, sometimes it was stressful when I didn't know kind of when things were, but I was able to really work with my school secretary, who was such an angel throughout the process. And I just kept reminding myself, like, this is really important. And, you know, I love my students, but I also have a life and I want to have kids. So I have to pursue this. So it was just a juggling act.
So people at work knew about all of this?
Initially, I kept it to myself. But once I realized that I was going to have to go in for monitoring, I told my principal at the time and my school secretary, who kind of arranges if you need coverage for your class. My mom really pushed me to tell them, and I'm so happy that I did, because I think it allowed them to be a little bit more sensitive to what I was going through. I think if they didn't know, it would have been really difficult to just keep taking off. But they were great. They worked with me so that I wouldn't always have to use some of my sick time or my personal time if I could get in by 8:30 or however the day would work. So my friends at work, a few knew. I didn't really become super open about my journey until probably last year. So we were almost a year and a half, 2 years into it. But I think telling certainly my boss was one of the best things I did early on.
What tips do you have for listeners about advocating for themselves?
So for me, it was hard, I would say, but I would want to remind them to it's your journey, and you are ultimately the one calling the shots and making the decision. So educate yourself. I think listening to the podcast, learning, talking to a lot of people, getting a lot of information. And that's really helpful in part of advocacy, because I think when you know more, you can do better or try better and kind of ask better questions. And I think if you feel like you're inconveniencing somebody by asking questions, your doctor, your nurse, it might be time to find a new clinic and to seek that out if you need to. And it's you call the shots. And it's so important to just advocate for yourself, because nobody else is ultimately. And even when it feels uncomfortable, I think it's super important to continue doing.
How has infertility changed you?
So this is a question I think a lot about whenever I listen to the podcast. And it was actually something I had a long conversation with my sister with a few weeks ago. And I think it's certainly made me a more, I think, empathetic person, and has made me realize that people go through so many things that nobody knows about. I think if I hadn't told anybody about my infertility journey, and there were lots of people that are in my life that didn't know about it, or maybe still don't know about it, they might not understand kind of my behavior or some of the things that I did or could have said or still say. And I think it has just opened my eyes that everybody is dealing with struggles, and we can't guess what those are. So it's so important to be kind, and so important to just kind of be aware of these things and kind of treat people that way. Treat people like as if they're going through something that you don't know what it is. I also think it's changed me in a sense that I have become a little bit more, not like reclusive, but I think I was definitely, I'm an introverted person, but I, throughout my journey, kind of trimmed some friendships and relationships and things that triggered me or were really harmful to me. So I think that I came inward a little bit and really focused with my family and kind of my few friends that were sympathetic and knew what was going on, and tried to protect myself a little bit more because I found that there was always triggers and things. And I think that made me kind of maybe not want to connect as much with people. Maybe that's what I should say, or connect as broadly with people, just have the few that I felt comfortable with.
Knowing what you know now, what is one piece of advice that you give to your past self?
Go to the RE sooner. Definitely that. And I think lean on people, like lean on your family. I think oftentimes for me, like I said, even in the last question, that I kind of tend to go inward. And I think there's a lot of people that want to help you. There's a lot of people that are empathetic, especially those that are closest to you, and not fight it so much. I think I was really obviously upset that my fertility journey didn't look like what was in my head and what I imagine. And that's okay. Like it's okay to let that go. There's grief with that, but it will look how you want it to look. And it might not be the way you want to get there, but it will kind of keep persisting.
What words of hope would you offer to someone who's still on their infertility journey?
I would say certainly advocate for yourself, but also I think your life doesn't always go as we planned, but sometimes I think about what I've learned through this journey. And I think as challenging and as upsetting and as hard that it is, you will learn a lot about yourself, and you're going to learn a lot about even your partner, and it will make you guys a lot stronger, whatever the outcome is.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Heather. Thanks for having me. And I'm excited to keep listening to the podcast.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.